hear you.
Okay. Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us for our panel tonight on the synagogue in the age of COVID-19, force for change, or lead from behind. Rosh Rabbi Karofkin, the Mar D'Astra, and all the other abundant and communal leaders, my name is Rabbi Sammy Bergman from Beit Midrash of Rowan Dove, and tonight, before we begin, I'd like to mention a few thank yous. First of all, tonight's event is the first event in a week-long Shavuaton of thought and inspiration by the Meir Beit Midrash on the Jewish community in the age of COVID-19. And in that vein, I would like to thank Miller Bernstein LLP for sponsoring our Shavuaton. I'd also like to thank the Bayit for hosting the Shavuaton this week and sending out all the emails and notifications about the Shavuaton to our community, and their adult education department for helping to plan the Shavuaton. So thank you very much for that. And finally, I'd like to thank tonight's panelists, Rabbi Daniel Karofkin, Mara D'Astra of the Bayit, as well as Rabbi Tershiner, Rosh Beit Midrash of Beit Midrash of Bordeaux, and Rabbi Jonathan Ziering, Ram at Yeshiva Migdal HaTorah. Special thank you to Rabbi Ziering, who has the privilege of being in Eretz Yisrael, but therefore the difficulty of being up at 2:50 in the morning. Rabbi Ziering, you are truly one of a kind. Thank you very much. Before we begin, a few words to introduce the panel. The advent of COVID-19 has disrupted normal life throughout the world, and certainly in the Jewish community. Due to the threat of the virus and the measures that governments have taken to restrict the effects of the virus on the community, our approach to communal life has changed drastically. And we have been forced to refrain from many of the gatherings which define Jewish life, such as Pesach Sedarim, Shirim, and Daily Minyanim. However, in more recent weeks, as society has begun to open up, there have been different approaches in the Jewish community regarding how to approach government recommendations and how to begin resuming normal synagogue activities. If that wasn't challenging enough, the murder of George Floyd and ensuing protests, rallies, and riots further intensified the political and social atmosphere. In times like these, we look to our synagogues and rabbinic leaders for guidance and a Torah perspective in terms of how to approach the challenges of our day. And that's what we should do. That's what the Torah tells us to do. In Parshat Shoftim, Perek Yizayin, the Torah says, Kipalein mecha davar la mishpat v'dam v'dam v'din l'din v'nega l'nega. If a case is too baffling for you to decide, be it a controversy or homicide, civil law or assault, the very book of Sharefa, matters of dispute be court, rise up and get up. Elamakom asher achar Hashem lokecha bo. You should ascend to the place that Hashem, your God, has chosen. And you shall go to the Kohanim, the Levim, and the judge that is in charge in those days. And you shall ask them, and they shall tell you the appropriate ruling. So the Torah tells us to question our rabbinic leaders in times of crises. Now, Rabbi Rudy Tarragon of Yeshiva Kolta once noted, the process of questioning our leaders when we are faced with difficulty is associated with the kamtah ve'alita, getting up and ascending. Considering the greatest problems of our generation, grappling with them and asking about them is a process of spiritual growth in and of itself. And for more information about what the authority of rabbinical leaders in our time is, you can turn to my share tomorrow at approximately 8 p.m. at this address. But tonight, in that vein, I'd like to begin that growth process of seeking the wisdom of the sages we have present on our panel tonight, and to plumb the depths of their thinking on the pressing issues our communities currently face. No pressure. No. We will give each of our panelists a chance to give an opening statement. Afterwards, I will begin our list of 5 questions and give each panelist the chance to respond. And each panelist will have approximately 5 minutes to respond to each question. If time permits, after we finish addressing our list of 5 questions, we will open the floor for other questions. And in that vein, let's begin with question 1. And also, each panelist will have the opportunity to give an opening statement. So we'll keep that in mind for the 5-minute time limit. Don't worry, I won't of sort.
Maybe we should do the opening statement before the first question.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, so we'll begin with opening statements. I apologize for that. So with the first opening statement, I would like to turn, please, to the Mar the Asra, the Bayit, Rabbi Karak.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Bergman. Thank you very much, Rabbi Torchiner, for organizing this very important event and for this whole concept of a Shavua Tone. One of the great assets that we have in the community is to have the Beit Midrash Zichron Dov and their tremendously innovative, inventive ideas of new methods, of new ways of presenting Torah ideas and Torah concepts in all different kinds of creative venues. And certainly, because of our isolation, this is certainly one of the more creative ideas that the Beit Midrash has come up with, which is to create a week-long program just for a shul. So we're very grateful. And Rabbi Zirin, you get the Medal of Valor for being up at 3 o'clock in the morning. God bless you, and you should remain young and vibrant and vigorous for many, many more years.
Amen.
So my opening statement is simply this. I was listening to one of the, you know, by now we've all been Zoomed ad nauseum, and in one of the lectures that I heard, I think it was Dr. Pelkovitz or one of the other religious psychologists who was talking about the idea of depression that is born from uncertainty. There is a certain nisayon, a certain test that all of us have been subjected to, not just the test of isolation, but the test of uncertainty, because all of us have a tendency to want to be able to map out the future of our lives, at least for the short term. The further we get away from the long-term future, the more uncertainty we know that there is. But at least the short-term future, we're used to being able to be in control of. And that's the one thing I think that probably has been most trying for us, perhaps on a subconscious level, is really not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen next week, what's going to happen in a month from now, and what's going to happen in 3 months from now. One of the most frequent questions that I guess get asked is what's going to happen for Shavuos, and now that Shavuos is gone, what's going to happen for Tisha B'Av, and then of course, what's going to happen for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And part of the anxiety that we're experiencing is that sense of uncertainty. Each community is opening up at a different point. We don't know what the consequences of those things will be. But I think that we can take comfort from the fact that this is not the first time that Jews have been subjected to uncertainty. As a matter of fact, the lack of uncertainty is something that's probably a new phenomenon that probably started for the Jewish people in the late 20th century. Really, for most of Jewish history, uncertainty was more the norm than it was the exception. But we really do have a pattern for this, something that we read in the Parsha, this past Shabbos. The Torah spends an inordinate amount of time talking about the way that the Jewish people would travel through the Midbar. And it goes through a series of psukim that start with the word D-H. Sometimes the cloud would rest and it would only be for a day. Sometimes the cloud would rest and it would only be for 2 days or 3 days. And then it would lift up after 2 or 3 days after everyone set up camp. And they would have to pack everything up all over again, the Mishkan and all of their tents and all of their livestock, and schlep out into the desert again. But the one key issue was that there was this uncertainty. They never knew how long they were going to be in any one place. And that invariably created an anxiety. As a matter of fact, the Mor Goshemesh writes that later on in the Parsha, when the Torah writes, Vayihi ha'am ki mitonanim, that the people were complainers. The word mitonein comes from the word onein, which is to be in a state of mourning. In other words, this uncertainty of how long we would be in one place and when would be able to move on was so grating on the psyches of Klal Yisrael that was more than anything else the thing that caused them to complain. It wasn't being in the desert. It wasn't the lack of meat. It was the uncertainty, the lack of being in control of our destinies, being in control of even our short-term futures. But that's something that Hashem tells us is part of the test of being a Jew, is not knowing what tomorrow will bring. The one thing that we can take sort of solace in, is that in past generations, that uncertainty was, will we have another meal to next week? Will we be able to survive another week? Now, it's when will our communities get back together? When will our shuls be able to reconstitute? What will Jewish community look like for the future? That's a mild anxiety, but we shouldn't downplay it. We should recognize that that's the cause of so much of the angst that we're experiencing today, and that's something that we should be prepared to discuss and be able to be to reassure our communities that while it's true that we don't know exactly what the future has to bring, but we're confident that somehow we will get through it together as a community. And those are my opening comments.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Krogan. Next, for the opening statement, we turn to Rabbi Jonathan here. Okay, can you hear me now? Admitted. Okay. So I'll be brief. So first, thank you for inviting me back. One of the few benefits of living on Zoom is that now it's, besides when it's 3 a.m, not particularly harder for me to get to learn with everyone in Toronto than it is for people who are local. So I want to just begin with a story, anecdote. So in my community, when we moved in just under 2 years ago, so we really moved into a new community. It's a new hilltop. And there was, no one really living here yet. There were no shuls. We all daven together, still do, in a government building that the government lets us use until we managed to build the first shul. And in Israel, not only do we not have a shul, but, building a shul is a given. We just haven't gotten to it yet. We're raising the money, we're building the foundation, but whether or not that shul should have a rabbi, that is a live question in Israel, because most shuls do not. Now, right before this all started, so the shul had a vote, and the shul voted overwhelmingly in favor of having a rabbi, which is a bit of an exception in Israel, but that was the direction that we took. But there were naysayers amongst the community. And then this all hit. And one of the things that we've heard many times since the beginning is that people wish they had a rabbi. Because in moments of crisis like this, even the Israelis who normally don't have rabbis in their shuls and think they don't need it because they learned in Hesder and they're capable of doing a Dvar Torah, and the Gaivayim are capable of running the Minyan, suddenly things got complicated and we were facing a new situation, and even the naysayers suddenly realized, we really wish that we already had had our rabbi. And I think that that story really frames for me the question as it was posed: should shuls lead or come from or lead from behind or lead from in front? Where I think that one of the things we've learned in this situation is that having strong leaders really can help us shape the direction that we take and can give people comfort and solace when it is most needed. So I've been thinking about these issues a lot and excited to continue discussing it with all the people who I learned the ropes from before I got here. That was the what gave me the leg up when they were looking for to put together the committee to search for a rabbi. So I got the Ole, sort of worked in Rabbanus slot on the committee. So these issues have been in my mind. And like I said, I'm happy, I'm glad that I get to discuss it with the people who first taught me the ropes. Thank you very much, Rabbi Ziri. And with the final opening statement, we turn to Rabbi Torchin.
Thank you very much. Rabbi Karapkin, thank you so much for not only this program, but for all the ways in which you make the Bayit a welcoming place for our Beit Midrash programming and for the model that you present for the community, something that made the Bayit a logical place for this conversation about the role of the shul and about the shul as a force for change or leading from behind. I think there's a lot that the community learns from seeing the way that you lead the shul and through the shul the community. And Rabbi Ziering, wonderful to have you on board. I'm so glad that you said yes and that Orah permitted you to participate. Also, would be remiss if I didn't thank the 70 plus people who are logged in right now for the program. Thank you very much for spending of your evening, as Rabbi Karapkin said. We're zoomed out and beyond. So the fact that people at this stage, a few months into Zooming, are willing to dedicate time in their evening is not something I take for granted. To me, the challenge with answering this question of force for change leading from behind is that shuls aren't a single entity. Shuls are actually many entities. And I think the question of whether a shul should lead from behind or be a force for change really depends on which arena you're talking about and which identity of a shul we're talking about. The Gemara in Megillah, Chavtes Amud Aleph, characterizes shuls as Mikdash Ma'at, a miniature temple. So if I look back at the original paradigm, I look at the Beis HaMikdash at the temple, and Shlomo HaMelech characterized that original temple as a place where Jews could go or to which they could turn to pray to God for any need, and Hashem is going to listen. God would listen. So I wish it were that simple for our shuls to say, okay, therefore that's what a shul is. A shul is a mikdash ma'at. It's a place where people go to pray, or a place towards which people turn to pray, maybe in the coming weeks praying in the shul parking lot as opposed to in the shul proper. But the truth of the matter is that for the Jew in exile, it's not only about the mikdash part of it, about being a sanctuary. It's also about the mi'at part of it. The recognition that a replacement for the temple or replacement for the Beis HaMikdash is a replacement for much more than that. It is a miniature of so many different things. It's a replacement for the building which Pirkei Avot says everybody fit into, and no one said, Tsar li amakom. No one said, I have no place there. A place where everybody gathered together, there was a unity of physical space. A shul has to be, again, COVID notwithstanding, a place where people will be able to cram in together and feel comfortable together. It also is supposed to be a replacement for a place towards which Jews turned with unity of mind. Right, you think about in Tanakh, Daniel in the palace in Babylon turning towards the Beis HaMikdash in prayer. The Jew riding his donkey in a Mishnah in Brachos and turning towards Yerushalayim. A Jew in Europe or North Africa during wars and crusades, or a Jew in Toronto today. It's all being of unity of mind, turned towards the Beis HaMikdash. Now we have to be turned towards our shuls. It's also about unity of purpose. The shul being a replacement for a central gathering place to which Jews gathered with the idea that they were all there for the same reason and there to celebrate together. Aliyah LaRegel. The Rambam says the main reason, or not the main reason, I think he says the main reason actually, for Aliyah LaRegel, for having Jews gathered together for the three holidays every year, was supposed to be in order to get Jews together with unity of purpose in one place. That also has to be represented in a shul. It also has to be a replica of the site where the Sanhedrin sat, the high court sat and dictated halachic policy for the nation. That's also part of being a shul. There's so much to this. One last one, the shul had to be the place which, again, the Gemara describes as a place in which no one was ever bitten by snakes and scorpions. It's a place of safety. So our shuls need to be a place where Jews daven and Hashem listens. But they also need to be places of unity, of space, of mind, of purpose, places of love for each other, places of halachic guidance, places of safety, all of which is challenged by the pandemic, by unrest. We're forced apart. We are of different minds. we're of different attitudes towards risk and danger, so we face a major challenge, including regarding the items that we're going to discuss tonight. And I think with each question, we need to find the right model of shul. What is it about the shul that is relevant for the particular issue that we're discussing? And I look forward to hearing what my co-panelists have to say about it. I just noticed a hand up in the from one of the participants, so I'll just reiterate what Rabbi Bergman kindly noted in the beginning, which is we're going to try to have time at the end for question and answer, depending on how things go. But if we stop for questions along the way, then I fear we're not getting through the questions that people came here to hear about. So first we're going to do our questions, and then we'll hopefully, if we have time, open the floor as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Torchander. Excuse me. And we'll begin with question one. As I think all of our panelists noted, the COVID-19 crisis has really challenged our ability to gather in shul. And there have been times where the government has said flat out that it's inappropriate and illegal to actually gather together to pray. However, there are other times where it's not as 100% clear. And there's a little bit of room for interpretation. We've had a bit of Rashi and Tosfot in terms of how you're going to interpret the directives and instructions of the government. And on that note, our first question is, when government recommendations for safety are open to interpretation, how should a synagogue make decisions? And we'll turn first to Rabbi Karofkin to address this question.
Thank you. Our shul was the first major shul in the GTA to shut its doors. I would be proud, and I'm proud of that. I would also be proud to say that we would be the last shul to open, although I'm not sure what the case will be. Why do I say that? We have to appreciate that, just like I started with this uncertainty principle, even the medical community doesn't fully understand this pandemic, doesn't fully understand this virus, and every governmental entity has been doing a guessing game to try to create a balance between, on the one hand, keeping new cases of the virus and fatalities to a minimum, and at the same time not completely destroying and crushing the economy, which could also have very, very negative repercussions, not only to economic structures, but also to people's real lives. And the government, as a result, has to play this balancing act. And some governments have opened earlier, some governments have opened later, but they're all playing the same balancing act. Once the government tells us that it's okay to reopen our places of prayer, that's not necessarily an indication that it's safe to do so. It's basically the government telling us that based on their unique calculus of safety versus economic opportunity, we feel that because we've opened up so many other things in society, we have to open up places of prayer as well and give everyone the freedom of choice to choose how they are going to assemble for their religious needs. It then becomes the role of the leaders of the congregation, both the rabbi and the lay leadership collectively, to decide what is in the best interests of our members. And for that, we consult with our medical team to the best of our ability. And we should always err on the side of pikuach nefesh, of saving and protecting lives and protecting people's health, over any other religious concern. Because the primary overriding religious concern in all of halacha, except with a very rare exception, is pikuach nefesh, is preserving our health. And that's why we've been very, very conservative. And I have more to say about it, and I want to reflect upon why it is that there have been differing approaches, if it's such a slam dunk what I've just said. In other words, if what I'm saying is so obvious that pikuach nefesh always trumps tefillah b'tzibur and any other religious needs or concerns, why is it that there have been conflicting opinions on when to reopen and how far we go to one side or to the other? And I'm going to save those reflections a little bit later because I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
I guess we're looking forward to those reflections, but we'll turn now to Rabbi Zirin to answer again question one. When government recommendations for safety are open to interpretation, how should a synagogue deal with it? So, when thinking about this issue, I've been helped along by the framing by one of my longtime chabrusas, Dr. Shlomo Zogir, who noted that if you survey basically all the rabbinic responses, he categorized the responses of those who said you should close shuls at some point into three categories. There were those who said we should close shuls because that's the law. Dina de malchuta dina, the law of the land is the law. Or it'll be a chil Hashem if we don't follow the health standards set out by the government. And the statement that those community leaders were making was, look, we don't necessarily believe in the calculus of the government. Either we don't believe the science, or we don't agree with the weight they're giving to each of the factors. But in the end of the day, we need to do whatever the government says. The second group, at the other extreme, is the view that Rai Karofkin so eloquently articulated, which in America has been championed by the RCA under Rai Karofkin's leadership. In Israel, Rav Asher Weiss has probably been the strongest proponent. Which is to say, as Rai Karofkin said, the way that halacha views danger is fundamentally different than the government. And halacha gives more weight to health concerns and less weight to the competing factors, and therefore we should always be more stringent than whatever view is articulated by the government, which is of necessity a compromise between health concerns and other concerns. And then there's the middle view, which basically says, look, there is indeed danger, but halacha allows for a certain amount of danger in your regular life. You're allowed to take a job that has a certain amount of danger. You're allowed to drive a car even though that has danger. But there's a principle in halacha of shomer p'tayim Hashem. You can only be involved in danger as long as it's something that God guards the fools. But the way it's understood in halacha is that whatever is considered normal, you can do. And that view says, look, the reason we would follow the government is not because, we're being forced to, but because we recognize there's a danger, but we also recognize that it's legitimate to engage in a certain amount of danger for important activities. And how do we judge what's normal? Whatever the government decides and what people are doing, that's normal. We don't have to go more. We definitely can't go less. But whatever, it becomes normal. So that is Shomer P'tayim Hashem. And what Rabbi Zuckier noted is that basically the responses that you see now break down along these lines. Those who felt that this was an issue of Pikuach Nefesh and that halacha judges the standard of what is necessary more stringently will obviously delay opening, not just when it's ambiguous, but will add 2 weeks to wait to see what happens. Those who said, look, we're only following because the government said so, so obviously if there's any ambiguity, they're going to jump on it because from the beginning they didn't believe it. The interesting view is going to be the middle, where when people judge it based on Shomer P'tayim Hashem, what is normal. So there, right, it's going to be some combination of judging, well, what are people doing that has similar risk? Right? And I don't have a good answer to this, but what I've seen more on social media just in the last few days were people saying, look, until last week, I was willing to say that it was dangerous to go to shul. I got it, I can go to work if I actually need to, I can shop for food, but that was necessary. But once I see people going to rallies to stand up for social justice, so then what you're telling me is that this is a legitimate risk to take for an important value. And now I'm questioning whether Shul should fall into that category. And that type of dialogue is much more in this middle category. We're saying, let's find parallels and see what has become accepted, and whatever is accepted, not because I deny the risk, but because I recognize it's legitimate to make risk more important reasons, let me follow that model. And while, you know, my sympathies may be with the more machmir view, I think this is a helpful framing to understand the why people might have been dragging their feet in certain cases, or actively saying, look, once we engage in other things, we have to, with integrity, treat Shul with the same stringency. And if we think, and we have sympathy for people who are risking, taking whatever risk there is for social justice, then maybe we have to entertain taking the same risk for davening. And at least that frames and gives a rationale to those positions, even if you might weigh in on, you know, with one of the other formulations, it at least gives language to the other two.
Okay. Thank you for that, Rizirin, for all three approaches. I'd love to press you on one or two or three of them, but I'd like to give everybody to Shushina his chance to answer this question, too.
Okay.
So, please go ahead, Shushina.
You are the moderator. You can press it.
I think what I'll do is I'll let everybody give their take, and maybe I'll have a few follow-up questions.
Okay. So I would like to go a little more abstract with this. And going back to my point about shuls having multiple identities, the Gemara has an institution called the Adam Chashuv, a person of standing, a person of stature, a role model within the community. Those who were there when we had our program on the ethics of commercial kasha supervision with the COR, I talked about this idea there as well. An organization that is held up as a leader for the community has the status that the Gemara calls Adam Chashuv. They are significant. They are of standing, and with that comes a degree of responsibility to go above and beyond. The Gemara in Moikata and Yitzayin Amid Aleph talks about a dayan, a judge on a rabbinical court. Hang on one second. My audio is not working well. Hold on. Zoom.
My friend Gina is just trying to get back his audio.
Okay, my audio should be fine now. You can hear me now? Yeah, okay. This happens. So the Gemara Moikad and Daf Yedzayin Amud Aleph requires the Adam Chashuv, the person of standing within the community, to be very careful to make sure that his conduct does not undermine faith in what he represents. In context, it's talking about a dayan, a judge, on a rabbinical court, and the fear that personal misconduct by the judge could actually undermine people's faith in the Beit Din, in the court itself. But beyond that, beyond the kind of do-no-harm requirement, is a second requirement. The Gemara in several places speaks of a requirement to go lifnim mishuras hadin, above and beyond what the law requires. And one of the parties who is required to go, lefnim mishuras hadin, to go beyond the letter of the law, as explained in various halachic authorities, is the Adam Chashuv, the person who is of stature within the community. That person has to go above and beyond. And that leads me to think that a shul will have an obligation to go beyond where others go when it comes to halachic requirements like looking out for the safety of its participants. There is a requirement to go lifnim mishuras hadin and to set a very high standard. At the same time, the shul also represents the tzibur, represents the community, and it's setting policy for the community. And the Gemara also teaches us that you're not allowed to set a policy for the community where that policy is too much for them to deal with. Right? You're not allowed to create decrees that the community can't bear. If you're going to issue a statement and say that people have to stay in their homes, that people can't interact, that people have to be socially distant to an extreme, you run the risk of creating what in fact we've seen within society over the last 3 months, which is a breaking point for people in various circumstances. You can't go too far. So I see two poles here. And I don't think it's a but, I think it's an and. I think there's a requirement for a shul to actually match both of these, to meet both demands. The shul is a leader, and as a leader, a maximum is demanded from it, and the shul is responsible to create a maximum standard, in this case regarding safety, I believe, as opposed to maximum regarding minyan. I think maximum regarding safety. And at the same time, to be accommodating and responsible to members and followers who can't meet a maximum standard. So that with each decision that the shul is going to make, there's an imperative for the shul to consider, on the one hand, we can't license and model bad behavior. We have to instead promote a policy that is above and beyond. That's what we have to model for the community. But at the same time, we can't demand too much of the community so that people are not able to follow where the shul is leading. And I think between those, there's a lot of room. But that's the challenge.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Well, I'd like to present two follow-up questions to this first question. I think it's an important one because I think we've all sort of been grappling with this one in our heads for a long time. The first one is, I guess, to Rabbi Karofkin's perspective that he presented, and also to one of Rabbi Ziering's approaches to this, and maybe to one of the polls Rabbi Rechiner has mentioned now, and that is as follows. So the notion of pikuach nefesh, as everybody will agree, is saving lives paramount in halacha. And even at the slightest doubt that there might be a question as to if someone might face getting in danger, we say, of course not. Mitzvos are always pushed away for to save lives. So that really is our perspective here. My question then is there ever a point where we say, okay, it's time to go back to shul, and why do you ever make that decision? Maybe we should just not go to shul until there's a vaccine, because you can't know definitively that no one will be infected by COVID-19, by having a minyan or attending a synagogue. So that would be my question in one direction. And I'd like to go the other direction also, and I'll give each participant the chance to answer both of these. And that is, Rabbi Ziering mentioned the idea that there have been many social gatherings recently, and people are sort of saying, well, if it's normal now to have social gatherings for rallies and the like, well, then why can't we go to shul? Apparently it is normal. Or to even note the government guidance that if the government is now opening up, then maybe we should consider going back to shul. And my question is, as Rabbi Karofkin mentioned, we have medical experts, we have rabbinic leaders, and who are familiar with the Torah perspective on these issues. So why does it matter to us what the government or people have been doing? We should follow what our experts tell us and act accordingly. So I hope those two questions were clear. One is, why is there ever a point where we say it's time to go back to shul if we go up nefesh is the overriding concern? And the second one is, why is it that we are concerned with government recommendations? We should make our own decisions. So I guess we'll start with Rabbi Karofkin.
Well, let me just, I'll approach the first question. I think Rabbi Ziering's analysis was probably helpful in answering the first question, that there are risks to one's well-being anytime we walk out of our get out of bed every day. There are risks of falling, there are risks of injuring ourselves on sharp things in our house. There are risks involving getting into a car, there's no question. There are risks in walking down the street. Anything can happen, and statistically it does. And yet, something that's dosh be'rabim, something that the public has already accepted as acceptable risk, like Rabbi Ziering said, Shomer B'Sayim Hashem, a person has the right to rely on the fact that God will protect us. The only issue that I would take sort of a little bit with Rabbi Ziering's analysis in that middle category, where people have felt at liberty to take risks because they've seen the public doing it, is that normally when we say that something is an acceptable risk, it's because society as a whole, over a prolonged period of time, has made something as an acceptable activity. I'm not sure if we would trace the history of the automobile in the early 1900s, whether there were poskim who said, don't get into a car until we know it's safe. In other words, there has to be sort of a track record of a certain activity where the statisticians can actually say, okay, this is the percentage of risk that's involved before we can say, gosh, may rob him and shomer tzayim Hashem, that once the public has become accustomed to this type of risk-taking, then a person has the right, halachically, tell me, what are you crazy going to a protest for Black Lives Matter or for whatever else the protest is about? You should stay away from people right now. You're in the midst of a pandemic. But you're passionate about the cause. So decide. If you're going to be passionate about the cause, then you're taking a risk with your life that's not considered acceptable. But a doctor would tell you that it's not an acceptable risk to take. So that's the only thing, is that I don't think that we can look at everything else that's going on in society and say, well, based on that, I have a right to take a risk with going to shore. I think we have to be more cautious. And as part of the statement that we drafted with the OU carefully pointed out, is that when you go to shul, it's not just going into a store or sharing a space with someone for just a few minutes. You're going in for, because a shul by definition is a social milieu as much as it is a religious milieu. You're going in for a prolonged period of time, especially let's say on a Shabbat morning. You're going in for 2, 3, sometimes even 4 hours to pray together with people, to socialize together with people, to schmooze together with people, hopefully not all in the same place, and hopefully not during davening. But all of those things are going on. Any of you who have been to the Bayit know that the amount of bodily interaction that takes place on a typical Shabbos morning is more than most people would interact if when they go to the park or when they go to the supermarket. There's actual, genuine, because we love each other. And we want to hug each other. We want to be close to each other. We want to share the same food with each other. And those are the types of risks that I don't think that we can look at what the rest of society is doing and say, well, based on that, let's go back to shul.
From his hearings, you want? Okay. So, first, I want to say that I do like being in the role of sort of, I don't have to make the decisions, so I can categorize the decisions that other people are making. And I don't envy people like Rabbi Kropkin who actually have to make the decisions, because it's much safer from the from this perspective. Honestly, you know, my feeling throughout this has been, I'll offer a few thoughts. One is that the Rav Herzog is in Tshuva. In the context of setting up police forces in Israel on Shabbat, and he says, look, we know that Safik Bikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbat, Svek Bikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbat, out upon doubt is Doche Shabbat. But there has to be some limit to this. There has to be some limit. And then he gets the million-dollar question, okay, what's the limit? And he says, I have no idea, but there aren't enough from police officers, so I don't really have to answer this question right now, so he just kicks it down the road. And it's, you know, Rishon Israeli critiqued it for this later, but at some level, you know, there is this question that we know there is some limit, but it's very hard to put your finger on it. And I think that's, you know, if nothing else, that's behind the motivation to err on the side of caution. Though at some point, right, there is a limit to it. Maybe to lighten the mood for a second, I have to get permission from my mother to share this story. Do I have permission to share a story from when I went to yeshiva?
Yes. Go right
ahead. Okay. So some of you might know, or maybe you don't. When this first started, I felt like I was brought back to, basically my entire life growing up at home, because my mother has been, until she retired, and now she's been brought out of retirement, has been an epidemiologist for about 4 decades. The extent to which this sort of shapes the way you can think about this, I'll capture the following story. When I was first going to Israel, my parents were a bit hesitant about me going to the Gush, because it's in the West Bank, you know, people are scared. And eventually my parents decided that they were okay with it, and I asked my mother what changed. And my mother said, well, at first I was scared because it's in the West Bank. I don't even know if you remember this.
statistically, is more likely for you to die of a disease in New York than to be killed by a terrorist anywhere, so you might as well go to yeshiva. Which is what I realized that, you know, sometimes when you think as an epidemiologist, you realize, you know, there are a lot of things we do that are dangerous, there are a lot of things that are always lurking, and yet we live our lives, and often it's the hidden dangers we don't think about that are more dangerous than the dangers that we do think about. You know, COVID-19 has made it that suddenly the things that we never thought about are the ones we do think about. But it's always been true that, you know, going to shul is dangerous, and young people always die from the flu if in much smaller numbers. That's why I don't think there is a great answer to it. You know, there has to be a limit, but really figuring out that limit is hard, and as Ray Karofkin said, I think that's why many rabbinic authorities have been erring on the side of caution. I'll make just one more point, and this is one of the things that I think has complicated it, and to be fair, complicates all medical decisions, all medical halachic issues. And that is that rabbis fundamentally are poskim. They understand halacha. They aren't doctors. But to poskim any medical shaila, you need knowledge of medicine. But what's often not articulated is that the process by which we get our information to fill in the halachic decisions that require medical information is not clear. There are poskim who will tell you, well, you know, ask your doctor that you trust. There are poskim who will say, try to get a consensus of doctors. Try to look at the statistics. Try to get a group of doctors and get a rogue. Right? These are all models that people have taken. And none of them are glot. Because in a global, where that might have worked, you know, 500 years ago, there were only two doctors in town. So you asked them, you got a consensus, that was the best you could do. Part of what complicates this is that the doctors don't know, and therefore, who are you going to ask to get that information, I think is, you know, I don't think there's a simple answer to it, but we need to acknowledge that when we're coming up with halachic decisions, rabbis know halacha, they rely on others for the medical information, and with that being so unclear, being so many different voices, and it being unclear how you're supposed to even gauge the reality, right, that complicates things, and I just don't think there's a simple answer, but at least acknowledging that complexity is critical. The only thing I would note is that Mr. Brewer has a suggestion that when you're picking a doctor, it should be someone who is, if not shomer halacha, at least sensitive to the halachic issues you're talking about. Because he says, look, at the end of the day, all of these, everything, whether to violate Shabbos, to eat on Yom Kippur, is going to be a judgment call. And the best you can do is try to find doctors who are at least sensitive to the counter pressures. And that's the best chance you have of coming up with a decision that will both be true to the halacha, but also take into account the medical reality, but be sensitive to the balance that needs to be bore out between the two values that are competing.
So,
do you want to share another thought with Regina?
So, I'll tell you the truth, I'd like us to get to question two. we had five questions, we're not going to get there, but I do want to make one very quick note. There have been references made to the fact that there have been, you know, rallies, protests, riots, whatever, you know, term you want to put on it, and how that seems, you know, you say, well, the people can get together for that, we should be able to get together for minions. So I want to make sure that we're really clear on the fact that this is a decision about relative importance, fundamentally. Meaning, and this is something that's been said, but I don't think it's been said in relation to the protests. Any time you're going to decide, do I go out, do I not go out, do I go to where there are other people or not, we ask ourselves, well, how important is it that I go out? We saw people before Pesach, when fear of COVID was at its height, who said, I'm still going to go to somebody else for a Seder because I don't want to be alone. And while that's something I didn't approve of, I understood where people were coming from when they did it. You heard about the funeral in Brooklyn a while back where, you know, a few hundred Jews got together, defying restrictions, because they felt that this was really important. Or, quite frankly, you looked at the parking lot at Sobeys the week before Pesach. There were an awful lot of people who were coming together in Sobeys because, to them, it was really important that they get what they want for Pesach. I think that when you're dealing with the protests, it's a little bit easy for people to sort of, you know, say, well, you know, why are they getting together for that, and we're not able to get together for shul? But I think to a lot of people who are attending the protests, these things are considered life and death. They consider these things to be very, very important, and I wouldn't necessarily try to draw analogies from that to minyan attendance.
Okay. So we want to question you. Thank you all for your thoughts. Maybe we'll try to move a little, but here's question two. So there's been an opportunity recently, as we just mentioned, to think about the way shul should run in the absence of gathering as we regularly do in synagogues. There has been time to contemplate what we should do when we get back. And the second question is, synagogues are in the process of resuming services. Should leadership restore what was, or experiment with new ideas? And we'll begin with Rabbi Grafi.
Thank you. I'll tell you something. I'll share with you an insecurity that I have about the future of not only our shul, but shuls in general. My insecurity and my fear is that people have learned that they can be religious Jews and actually have very rich religious life outside of the synagogue. And my fear is, I don't know to what degree this is going to be realized or not, but my fear is that people will come to the realization, hey, you know what? I can daven and be outside of shul. I can actually sometimes even have a more meaningful davening when I'm outside of shul, where there's not the talking, where there's not the noise, there's no distractions. I can spend more time with my family on a Friday night if I don't go to shul, etc., etc. You can fill in your own blanks. Now, and here only this compounds my anxiety, and that is we're going to start going back to shul. But we're not, you know, we have to appreciate that the attraction of shul, and this sort of goes back to what I said, I would come back to this later. The attraction of a synagogue is not purely that it's a place where I can pray to God. Because we know, halachically, you can pray to God anywhere as long as the place is clean. The part of the attraction of shul is the social dynamic that exists within it, where I get the sense that I'm with my kinsmen, I'm with my kindred spirits, and I have a chance to express myself in a virtuous way, to engage in a virtuous activity, but in a social structure that makes me feel good. And when we first come back to shul, we're not going to be the same social structure that we were before, because we're going to be distanced from each other. We're going to be wearing masks. We're not going to be gathering for any kind of food after the service is over. Essentially, we're going to be coming back to shul, but without so many of those social amenities that makes the experience of going to shul that enjoyable, that pleasant. And so part of my anxiety is that people, even the people who do start coming back to shul, you know, when we go back to our 30% capacity, or if that capacity gets increased in the province, is that people are going to feel this is a bit bland. It doesn't have the same time that I was hoping that it would have when I remember 3 months ago going to shul, and there was a greater sense of conviviality and social interaction that is not there. Now, how does this address the question of what's going to change in the future? Well, again, it's uncertain what's going to change, but one thing I do know is that the social dynamics, at least in the short term, are going to be very different. We have to be prepared for that, and we have to realize that if I do want to go back to shul, it's going to be much more focused on my ability to gather exclusively for prayer to God, and much less on the social benefits of that religious activity than perhaps it used to be in the past. Will we want to experiment with that to maintain that? I don't know, because I do believe that the health of the community hinges upon a healthy social dynamic. And obviously, no one's advocating that people talk during davening. No one's advocating that people leave them in the middle of davening to go out and have a kiddush or a discussion group. That's not what we're advocating, but we do acknowledge that the social aspects of a synagogue are as vital for a person of faith as prayer itself. And if we don't do something to preserve that social dynamic, then the prayer itself could disintegrate and not capture the hearts and minds of the people that we are trying to help connect with Hashem. So, while I do hope that the absence makes the heart grow fonder dynamic will apply, people will take their davening more seriously and will compartmentalize their socializing from their davening, and shul will be quieter. People will be more sober during prayer. People will wait until the end of davening to go out for kiddush, etc., etc. But I also recognize that the social dynamic must continue in some way, shape, or form. Otherwise, we run the risk of disintegration of the community, even when we reopen our shuls.
Thank you. Mr. Missouri, do you want to address this question?
I'll weigh in very briefly, because I know we need to move on to that question. I do think that there's going to be some sort of, there's going to be a little bit of both, meaning there is going to be some at which, I hear from people as, again, we've moved back to shul 6 weeks ago at this point. So there is definitely an element of people who forgot that they, or never knew that they actually liked certain parts of shul, have suddenly learned that they do. And we should capitalize on that for as long as we can. Reminding people that they missed this. They missed davening, they missed minyan, right? They missed kriyat haTorah. They missed everything that shul's about, not even just the social things, but they missed everything that shul is about. But on the other hand, I think that we would be remiss if people found avenues of spirituality that spoke to them that they never would have found if it weren't for this shutdown. And those can be integrated either into shul, or shuls can help promote people pursuing these things as part of their spiritual life. I think we would be remiss to not encourage people to do that. Now, that means different things for different people. I'm sure there are people who have been inspired by and never thought they would be inspired by weekly musical kosutzes on Zoom, which have been provided by many wonderful rabbis around the world. And if there are communities where people found that meaningful, I don't see why that shouldn't be something that possibly continue. And I think what we're going to be negotiating in the coming few years is, on the one hand, reminding people that they really did like the things that we didn't have for as long as we don't have it. But on the other hand, I think it would be a shame if we didn't really think hard about what worked and what did we learn about ourselves in this experience, and find ways of integrating that into the post-COVID life. Thank you. Reiner Chiner, would you like to address this issue?
Sure. My first point, just to add to Karapkin, would be to remind you, although I'm sure you haven't forgotten, that you actually asked for this problem. Your Shabbos Shuva Drasha that you gave this year, I think you suggested at the time that people should occasionally miss minyan and daven at home, and you would find that to be a meaningful experience. So don't be upset if people find it meaningful. They're taking your advice. We just took a little too far, perhaps. But in terms of the overall question here about experimentation. I think shuls need to innovate. I think it's very important. Going back to my point about shuls having different models, so one key piece of the shul identity is that it represents the tzibur, or represents the community. The Gemara in Haryo says, "Ein tzibur mesim." The community never dies. Now, on the one hand, the community never dies, meaning that there is always a carryover, there's always a new generation, and people remain from the old and teach the new, and that can make change difficult, because people like stability. The community is what the community was. But the reason why the community doesn't die is because it also has those new elements that come into play, and you need that new growth. You need the adaptability. And this is something Jewish communities have seen over time in a variety of circumstances, whether you're talking about Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai's enactments after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash as a very extreme example. You're talking about the enactments by Rabbeinu Gershom in the 10th century, in which to a certain extent he was reinforcing the old and to a certain extent he was introducing the new. Whether you're talking about the rise of Kabbalah and Lurianic Kabbalah in the 16th century or Hasidus or all the different movements that have come along over time, I think there's a responsibility for our leadership to guarantee that in fact Ein Tzibur Mesim, that the Tzibur doesn't die. That yes, we honor the old and we perpetuate the old, but we also recognize that you need the new, and this does present us with a gold mine of an opportunity to try to create things that are new, solve problems that we know we have, that we've known we had for a very long time, with a new method, with something that you can do when there's been a disruption like we've had.
Okay, thank you. We all look forward to some of those innovations and what they might be. I'd like to move on to we're going a little bit short on time, so I'm actually going to combine the third and fourth questions, but it's a pretty important and charged topic. Now, let me phrase it as follows: we all were unfortunately dumbfounded by what happened to George Floyd in the recent news cycle. I'm confident that we can all call out how horrific and tragic that was. I'm confident that everybody on this call is willing to call out racism and acknowledge that we need to do the best that we can to eradicate the issue of racism. But my question is twofold. The first is, what should our priorities be? On the list of priorities that a shul and community has, all the wonderful things that a shul engages in, and all the things that we need money for, How should anti-racism or anti-pandemic activities be on that list? So that's to what extent should a synagogue devote resources to chesed during a pandemic or anti-racism activities during an interracial crisis? And I think the follow-up to that is, of course, we have to fight racism. We acknowledge that there have been very different viewpoints politically as to exactly how to fight that racism and what measures need to be taken. You know, there have been people who are calling for drastic changes to the police forces, and there are those who are silencing those voices, calling for drastic changes to police forces. My question is, should a shul ever take a political stance when there's a politically charged issue at hand? Is that something that it's the role of a shul rabbi or community to do? Or do we call out what's obviously wrong? Racism is wrong, the murder was horrific, and we stay away from the charged political issues. And so again, to answer those questions, we'll begin with Rabbi Karam.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Bergman. Look, I can't even tell you at this point what was the motivation for George Floyd's death. The current narrative was that it was racially motivated, but yet we've discovered that the dirty cop who killed George Floyd actually knew him because they worked together. So for all we know, it may not have been racially motivated at all. I have no idea. But every few years when something like this happens, when a black man gets killed seemingly or apparently incorrectly, unjustifiably, because either he was unarmed or he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or a police officer overreacted, perhaps based on his color, the color of his skin, it allows us to do a Jewish community historically hasn't always been stellar in that area. And we just have to do a cheshbon on nefesh whenever these kinds of things come up. What about all of the other political things that have happened in the course of this maelstrom that we've gotten ourselves caught up in, with all of the agitation, with all the Antifa and the anarchy that has been taking place? What about the shuls that have been defaced in California and in other places, and the anti-Semitism that we've seen as a result? Those are all things that need to be addressed. We shouldn't sweep those things under the rug. And even when we see people in the Black Lives Matter movement behaving in an anti-Semitic way, or the anarchists that behaving, doing acts of anti-Semitism, that shouldn't stop us from doing that cheshbon ha-nefesh, that reckoning to ourselves and saying, if God is sending this message on a global level to society as a whole, that a black man was targeted perhaps unfairly and becomes now the cause celeb of society, fairly or unfairly, justifiably or unjustifiably, what message am I supposed to take out of it as an individual, and what message should I take out of it as a community? So to that end, I can just tell you that I've been involved with the RCA. We're going to have two webinars addressing the issue of racism within Judaism. Does it exist? Does it not exist? How do we address it? How do we not address it? I was in yeshiva with a man who is a convert to Judaism. He grew up as a black man in Detroit. And I reached out to him because we thought maybe I could have a dialogue with him for the benefit of the public. He told me a little bit of his story. He's a musmach. He has rabbinic ordination probably from more sources than I do. He's a Talmud Chacham. He rose through the ranks of various yeshivas, including Yeshiva University. But he shared with me that he ran into roadblocks along the way, both when it came to shiduchim and when it came to his career, his chosen vocation as a rabbi, because of the color of his skin. And just that we as a frum community were not prepared to accept. And it hurts me. It hurts me to acknowledge that it exists within our community. And regardless of everything else that's going on, that's the one thing that I think that we as a community can take from it, and we should address it. We should talk about it. What about all of the other unfair and unjust things that are happening? What about anti-Semitism? That needs to be discussed too. It's very complex, but we can't take one issue and say, well, because of those crazies on the other side, I don't have to deal with the problems that exist within Klal Yisrael. I don't have to deal with the problem of the fact that we constantly segregate and otherize people, whether it's Ashkenazim versus Sephardim, whether it's Hasidim versus Misnagdim, whether it's Orthodox versus non-Orthodox. We do have that issue. We've created clans within Klal Yisrael, sometimes in a healthy way, but sometimes in an unhealthy way. And that's what I think we should all be taking from the current events, from the headlines.
Do I like Garofian? And we'll turn to my hearing now. So I'll say briefly that, I think, going back to some of the points Roy Turchiner made in his introduction, a shul, especially a shul in Chutz La'aretz, has a lot of different facets to it, and under that rubric of, under that framework of what a shul is, I think there's definitely room for, without getting to the details of how much resources should be allocated to each thing, there's obviously room for the community to be involved in I think you said, right, chesed, which I think every stand, shul, right, takes as a given, that we have, resources for Bikur Cholim and Nichol Mavedlim and things of the sort. But for other things as well, it's important for us to allocate those resources. I don't think it necessarily has to be the shul. I think this, I don't know how much I can add over what Roy Garofkin said, except to provide the Israeli perspective here, which is to say, right, I think it is plausible to talk about not what does a shul need to do, but what does the Jewish community need to do, and say, look, there are certain things the community does that are not under the auspices of the shul. Like here, even though in America it's a given that
said, just under the auspices of the shul, it's not necessarily given here in Israel, not because the shul is stingy, but because, you know, there's a local tzedakah organization or chesed organization that takes care of those things, and everyone is involved in the shul and involved in those chesed organizations. And I think that's a legitimate model. And, you know, while by chesed, I don't think you lose anything by having it under the same roof, right? And, you know, if a shul wants to take on chesed, that's great. And if you have an organization that partners with the shul to take on chesed, that's also great. When it comes to politically charged issues, the divorcing of the two model might be healthy. Because that, on the one hand, recognizes that it's legitimate for members of the community to channel their resources from a Torah perspective, and because they're influenced by Torah values, to things that are not, you know, in the limited sense, shul focused, without getting the shul necessarily involved with things that, you know, with politicized issues that can alienate people. So, you know, I think there's definitely room for the community to be involved. But I think that recognizing that not everything that the community should be involved in necessarily has to be the shul, and opening space for other organizations to partner with the community might be helpful to negotiate some of the tensions that come when we put everything under the umbrella of the shul, which is one of those things I've learned, you know, living in Israel, where really a lot of those things, you know, even chesed, which is so parative, is already divorced from the shul, so kal vachomer things which are much more tense.
Thank you. And Rabbi 13.
Thanks. So I agree very much with the things that Rabbi Korobkin said and that Rabbi Ziering said. You know, to borrow from the framework that I was trying to establish before, the shul is an Adam Chashuv. The shul is an entity of stature. And it leads, and it's supposed to lead, even though, as Rabbi Ziering has noted, it can't be everything, and it's not healthy for it to be everything. Nonetheless, the shul has to say certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and certainly never let itself be misconstrued as supporting something that is wrong. In the beginning of this program, somebody had a note in the chat. They received an email from an outreach organization. I think it was with a picture. I have to go back and take a look, but with a picture of tefillin and a slogan on it saying "Black Lives Matter." I frankly find that offensive. I think that's terrible, and I don't know who sent it out, and I'm not meaning to malign whoever did, but you know, I would make an analogy, which I hope doesn't offend people, but I would make an analogy. A few years back, when three Jewish young men were kidnapped in Israel, and we had a slogan, "Bring back our boys," imagine if some organization had taken that slogan and used it, you know, for their purposes. I think we would have been correctly very angry. To me, you can't do that in a shul. I think, and there goes my speaker again. Hang on one second. Okay, speaker should be back.
Maybe just go over the comparison you made there, because that's when it started getting staticky.
Okay.
Like, what did it feel like?
No, that wasn't audible. Maybe there's a reason it wasn't audible. Maybe I should leave it be. We had a slogan a few years back when three young Jewish men were kidnapped in Israel, and we had a. I'm going to start a backup Zoom, I think, next time someone else is speaking, just to have that available on my phone. But we had the slogan "Bring back our boys." When three young men were kidnapped in Israel several years ago, and of course we know how it ended, that they had been killed. I would be very upset if some organization had taken that and used it as a "bring back our boys" as a slogan for some campaign of theirs. And I think that for Jews to take "Black Lives Matter" and turn it into "Black Lives Matter," I think is inappropriate. An organization, a shul certainly, as an Adam Chashuv, as somebody of stature, has to play a certain role within the community, including declaring right, right, and declaring wrong, wrong. On the other hand, because there's always an other hand, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra was a major halachic authority. He was born, I think, in Spain, was a rabbi in Cairo, was a rabbi in Israel, back in the 16th century, 17th century. And he was asked about creating a breakaway shul. When is it appropriate to start a new place to daven? When is it appropriate to create a new shul? And his answer was that if you can't daven with other people, if you look at other people and you're just angry, you can't concentrate anymore on your davening, then it's time to go elsewhere. A shul has to be a place where people feel like they are able to daven together, to feel unified with others, and to have kavana. So a shul can't put itself in the situation in which, because of its public statements, it alienates those who are davening there or causes rifts and schisms among those who are there. So you have two poles. On the one hand, the shul's got to call it for what it is. What's right is right, what's wrong is wrong. And at the same time, the shul has a responsibility to be very, very careful about not chasing people away and not creating rifts. Sometimes the answer is, as Rabbi Ziering said, let another organization be the one to speak louder on it. But I think a shul can never let itself appear to endorse something that's wrong, and needs to be willing to say that what's right is right.
Hey, thank you. So actually, we have one more question, but I kind of would like to go to the questions in the chat that were already mentioned. Is that okay? I want to. Okay, we're gonna machine here? Okay. Perfect. So let's go to some of those. I guess, should we stop in maybe a few minutes? We're hearing it's 4 or 7 in the morning. I feel very bad.
I heard them whiz and then already told me I can daven chakras, you know?
Okay, great. So, I'll read the first one. The first one actually has to do with the graphic of Black Lives Matter on the fill-in. And whether that's appropriate, I think Rader Sheener did address that. So let's go to another one. Here. Shul can be noisy. My home is not, and my prayer is better focused at home. Was it noisy in temple times? Question mark. Thank you. I want to return that question to say, look, I like God. Shul is noisy. Should I really be so anxious to get back to Shul?
And does anybody want to take that? Well, I guess raise your hand if you'd like to. Rick Rockin?
Well, I think I already addressed that. It's true. I mean, there are many distractions that can come about inside a synagogue, in any synagogue, not just ours. That's why Rabbi Terchiner correctly said that Chabashuvai told people, sometimes, and by the way, my motive for saying it was not because I felt that the shul was noisy, but rather because my observation is sometimes we get ourselves into a routine. We get ourselves into sort of a habitual kind of behavior, and it loses its meaning because it becomes so habitual. So it's very common in a shul for someone to come on their way to work to really be moser nefesh, because they get up an extra half an hour to an hour earlier, and they run to shul, but at the same time, they're zipping through davening, half awake before they've had their coffee, not really focusing so much on the words. It's worthwhile to break the habit so that we can take a step back and realize what we're actually doing. That, I think, is the benefit of occasionally davening at home. But the fact of the matter is, we all know, at least for men, and there is a distinction between the genders in halacha, that for men, a minyan that gathers as the Shekhinah come down, as the divine presence come down, whereas when a person prays by themselves, the prayers have to be transported up to heaven instead of the God's divine presence descending to receive the prayers. It's got to travel a little bit farther, and the prayers, therefore, can get waylaid, and you get lost on the way, or garbled on the way on some level, according to the mystics. And that's why tefillah b'tzibur, prayer with a community, with a preferred form of prayer, provided that qualitatively everything else is equal. So if a person really is very, very sensitive to noise and they can accomplish more in their prayers by davening privately, then we would say create a healthier balance in your life between public and private prayer. Don't jettison public prayer completely, but at the same time, spend a significant amount of time in private prayer as well.
I'm going to move to another question, and maybe we'll stop after this one. Is that work for Georgina or Tony?
It's really up to, well, first of all, we still have quite a few people, you know, here. No one's forcing them to stay. And I know Rabbi Ziering and Rabbi Karapkin both had thoughts on the last question. So,
okay.
I don't have to say anything about it, but they might want to do so.
Okay, so we can go to that last question then. Okay, so question, which was originally question 5. Leadership shown by Orthodox rabbinate during the pandemic seems to have muted critics. Do you think that a newfound trust in the Orthodox rabbinate will last? I guess we'll start with Rabbi Karapkin.
It's a funny question. How did you start it off, Rabbi Sammy?
I'm going to be honest, I didn't make this question, but I think I did.
Yes.
It starts off with the presumption that leadership shown by the Orthodox rabbi during the pandemic apparently has been stellar, and people are in awe, and it seems to have muted critics of the Orthodox rabbi. Muted critics, meaning that people are not as critical.
Right.
Do you think that the newfound trust in the Orthodox rabbi will last?
One can only hope, of course, but I don't know. It's so difficult to really approach this question. It's a minefield. Look, on the one hand, it's true that I think, let's say, the poskim that have come out of the OU and the RCA have been really, really moser nefesh to try and deal with so many of the very, very difficult life and death questions that have come up as a result of this pandemic. And the rabbinic community as a whole, both in Eretz Yisrael and in North America, have really stepped up and have made a relevant and significant contribution to Jewish community, despite the fact that we can't physically gather together. There's no question. There has also been a demonstration that when it comes to communal leadership, there is not consensus. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the slogan that was circulating in several venues that I saw before Shavuos was that Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad, like the slogan of Shavuot, is that we're supposed to be like one person with one heart when we're standing around Mount Sinai. Does not mean that we have to all agree with each other. It just means that we have to be unified in purpose. And I happen to agree with that. And we've all made peace with that. That 10 Jews, 11 opinions. That's just the way it's going to be. I lament the fact that there's not greater consensus. I lament the fact that perhaps even in our own, we're speaking in Toronto, in the larger Toronto area, there's been an attempt. We've all worked peacefully with each other, but it almost seems that sometimes we've sort of existed on parallel planes of existence and parallel planes of community. And while that's fine, and it's okay, and we coexist peacefully, I wish we could do better in the sense that I wish that there was even greater unity as far as a meeting of the minds. I don't want to go too far into this, but when we talk about confidence in the rabbinate, one of the things that I think that the public has come to the conclusion at when seeing the various different opinions from various different communal rabbinic it's also allowed certain fissures and cracks in our communal structure to become more visible at the same time. And one of the things that I'm looking forward to with the closure, with the end of the pandemic, is to the end of all of these different opinions of different shuls and different rabbis as far as how to approach specific health issues revolving around pikuach nefesh and religious services and so on. I'm sort of looking forward to that, and I hope that our community is able to overlook some of the serious differences among the different religious leaders when this is all over.
Thank you. So we'll turn to Rabbi Ziering for his thoughts on this.
Okay, so I mean, you know, I found it interesting. I've seen several people say, and I, you know, I wasn't in, you know, I haven't been in North America for this, but I've seen several people comment, you know, colleagues or rabbis, that they felt that, you know, at least at the height of this, you know, a lot of the hot button issues didn't seem so important. So people who were constantly criticizing the, let's say, the centrist Orthodox leadership, modern-Orthodox leadership, suddenly found newfound trust in them, because when it came to the big issues of life and death and how do we protect our community, suddenly they found themselves on the same page. And the same people who are often the critics of their rabbis on the hotbed issues suddenly were their biggest supporters. And I saw you know, colleagues questioning whether that would last, which is what, you know, led me to write that the question. You know, I don't know if I know the answer, right? I think that, as is always in life, I think the negative is easier to predict, right? I mean, people have talked about how the Haredi leadership in Israel especially has weakened in the eyes of their followers in ways that may not be reversible, because, you know, losing trust is much harder to reverse than gaining trust. Now, there's no way of knowing whether the people who had, you know, not great responses at the beginning will ever gain back the trust, but there are many who have pointed to trends in the Haredi community that have indicated that certain things won't be reversible, such as, you know, there's been more internet use by members of that community than there ever was, and it's hard to... Right, and if a lot of the power comes from isolationism, that's not reversible, at least not completely. The question of the opposite of whether, you know, people will be able to remember that, you know, when it came to the big issues, they trusted their rabbis, even if they might quibble on the hot button issues that took up so much of our time, you know, a few months ago. You know, that I'm really not sure. And, you know, I saw people who were hopeful at the beginning, but by seeing how many people were angry on both sides of the Atlantic, the decisions that shuls made about when opening, do you open right away to men and women, or do you start with men? To just give one example, and the without getting into that issue, but just seeing the renewed anger and indignation and passion in those conversations, you know, I'm a little bit, I tend to wonder whether we will remember in a few months from now that we agree on a lot more than we disagree on, because people like to pick on the things we disagree on. I hope it's not true. I hope that one of the things we can walk out from here is that on the big issues, we often agree and therefore be more civil, even when we argue passionately about things we don't agree on. But only time will tell whether that'll actually be the case. That's my thoughts on what I've, you know, been observing in the last few weeks.
Thank you. I don't know if Richard, do you want to address this? I'd also follow up with just what do you think we can do to help gender and create that trust?
Look, Moshe Rabbeinu had to keep on earning the nation's trust. Like, why should it be any different for us? It was Rabbi Ziering's question indeed. I don't think that I've observed that newfound trust. I don't know that I've really noticed that so much. But I think it'll have to be earned day after day. I think that's human nature, and it's what Torah demands of us. That's what I would say.
Okay. So do we have time for one more question from the chat, or do you think maybe we should we'll do one more question, and then we're gonna we'll call it. Okay. So this is sort of a follow up to the third and fourth question we combined today, which is, are we ready to look at the Ethiopian community in Israel and how they are treated as people of color? I guess sort of rephrase the question, given all the talk about racism recently, now, how should we address the issue of racism in our community? How should we address the treatment of Ethiopian Jews in Israel? I feel our steering might be, as a citizen of Israel, sensitive to that issue, or really even what Rick Rockin was referring to before, a scholar of great accomplishment who happens to be of African-American descent who can't get the job that he deserves. Are we ready to look at these issues, and how can we?
I don't want to go out of order here.
No, please.
Okay.
It's already past my bedtime, so.
Me too.
Well, it's time for you to get up, Rabbi Zering. But back in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, there were articles from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, from Rabbi J. David Bleich on this side of the Atlantic, Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, various halachic authorities in Israel, all saying the same thing. The question of the halachic status of Ethiopians who say they are Jewish is completely independent of and must be independent of the issue of color. Rav Moshe wrote very memorably that it would be abhorrent to Judaism to make this about color. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik has a whole essay on it. From a halachic perspective, Rabbi J. David Bleich said, Judaism is colorblind. There's no, whether they're Jewish or not, can't be in any way connected to a matter of of skin color. That said, it's also very clear that there was a movement back in the 40s and 50s, in the early days of the state, continuing something that had been going on for decades beforehand, to try to bring Ethiopians to Israel. And it changed when Rav Herzog gave a psak that said they weren't considered Jews halachically. Why he did that is its own discussion. But that became the heter, that became the basis for elements within government to say, well, then we don't need to push for them, and that's good because we're not so sure we want them here. There was an element of racism in that decision in the 50s that wasn't Torah-based, but it used Torah as its fig leaf. It was a decision, made and implemented by people who were not observant. It wasn't something that came from Torah. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that pure Torah and pure halacha will never recognize any sort of distinction based on color. However, there have been those who made such a distinction for their own reasons and used Torah conveniently to cover for that and to provide that as a basis for a racist approach.
Thanks. Does either Rabbi Karofkin or Rabbi Zering want to address this? Okay, Rabbi Karofkin.
No, I just mentioned before that it's times like this which allow us to do a cheshbon on nefesh. And let's face it, there is racism that still exists within our communities, whether it's calling blacks schwarzes, which is, yes, people will say that it just means black, but it has a certain connotation. Whether it's looking at all Gentiles as less than, whether it's looking at other ethnic groups as being an enemy or being bad, racism is alive and well in our communities, and we have to start thinking more critically about why it exists and to start address it. I do address it from time to time. I think that these these are opportunities for us to help raise up the level of tolerance within our communities. Tolerance, by the way, doesn't mean that, oh no, if I'm tolerant, that means my son or daughter is going to marry a Gentile. It's not what tolerance means. It just means showing that Kavanah Brios, showing the dignity and respect for every single human being. By the way, I should point out that there's a greater level of Kavanah Brios that we encountered when we moved to Canada than in the United States. And so it's interesting that a few of the Canadians that I've spoken to about this have told me that this whole issue of race is much more of an American issue than it is a Canadian issue. Now, there's a politician named Stockwell Day who got himself into trouble by saying that there's no systemic racism within Canada where there is in the U.S. I'm not prepared to go that far. We do have to call it out, and we have to do a cheshbon nefesh and look at ourselves. But at the same time, I am grateful to be living in a country which does not have the same sordid history of slavery as the U.S., and also doesn't have the same type of classification of people based on economic status and ethnic status as perhaps the U.S. does.
Okay. Do you want to add anything to everyone's hearing?
I agree with those who are searching around right crop. Yet, you know, Israel has its own challenges in that regard. And there are problems of racism here, and they, you know, they have to be dealt with. You know, the exact way that it manifests itself is somewhat different here. In America, sometimes you'll hear people saying, you know, that one of the reasons they can't spend as much time maybe worrying about racism is because they are facing anti-Semitism or something along those lines, which I don't think is legitimate. But in Israel, there is no such cover, right? Meaning in Israel, we're the majority. And therefore, any racism that is in Israel, you can't say, well, I don't have time to think about it because we're the minority and we're also attacked. And, you know, unless the other minorities stand with us, we can't stand with them. I don't think it's a good excuse in America, but in Israel, that doesn't even exist. Which does just sort of change some of the sociological implications. But, you know, that only makes, I think, racism more, the only thing I would add is that in Israel, when there is racism, that burden falls much more squarely on the shoulders of the Jewish people, right? We can't say we're being swept up in we're part of a society that has systemic racism and we're just part of it. If there's racism here, it's all on us. Which I think, to the extent that it exists, and it does, in Israel we have double the obligation to root it out, considering that reality. But, you know, history, the importance of rooting it out, I don't think we can add to what Reuter Schiener or Karofkin said. Again, just noting that the reality here is different and only makes the obligation greater.
Okay. I think at this point we're just about out of time. So I would like to remind everyone this panel was just the beginning of the Shavuot Talmud of Learning and Inspiration. You can find more information and materials at toronto.com/community. So please join us from Monday to Friday. Tomorrow at 8 p.m., I will be speaking about the topic of communal policy in the city with many Mare Da'asra, and would love to learn with everyone again. At that time, thank you again to our sponsor, Miller Bernstein, LLP. Thank you again to Bayit and their education community for all their efforts in promoting this program. Thank you again to our panelists, Rabbi Karofkin, Rabbi Ziering, especially, who's still up at 4:30 in the morning, and Rabbi Hershiner for sharing your time and your wisdom. And have a wonderful evening and a wonderful
Thank you very much.